Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 19th of October. Matt Taibbi is our guest this hour. He is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine and wrote a piece. We're going to talk about health care reform, sick and wrong, how Washington is screwing up health care reform and why it may take a revolt to fix it. He says in the article, the system doesn't work for anyone. It cheats patients and leaves them to die, denies insurance to 47 million Americans, forces hospitals to spend billions haggling over claims, and systematically bleeds and harasses doctors with the specter of catastrophic litigation. Even as a mechanism for delivering bonuses to insurance company fat cats, it's a miserable failure. Greedy insurance bosses who spent a generation denying preventive care to patients now see their profits sapped by millions of customers who enter the system only when they're sick with incurably expensive illnesses. Matt is joining us this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. The phones are working now. And the email address is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. I need to read you just a little bit about Matt, because he has this incredible life and he's a young guy. He worked as a freelance reporter in the former Soviet Union, including a stint in Uzbekistan. He was deported in 1992 after writing an article for the Associated Press that was critical of the president of that country. He was also, at the time of his deportation, the starting left fielder for the Uzbek national baseball team. Came back to the States, worked as an investigator in a Boston-based private detective agency. He went back to Russia in 95 and played pro baseball for two Russian clubs. Then he moved to Mongolia, and in 1996, he played professional basketball in the Mongolian Basketball Association. And he eventually settled in Moscow and worked. He founded an English language satire newspaper called The Exile. He did a lot of participatory journalism. He returned to the U.S. for good in 2002, founded the Buffalo-based newspaper The Beast. He has won many awards, the National Magazine Award for columns and commentary for three columns he wrote in Rolling Stone, Worse Than Bush, My Favorite Nut Job, and Obama's Moment. And he's written a couple books as well. But what a life, huh? What a life. So we'll talk about healthcare with Matt. Hello, Matt. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
What a bio you have. Isn't that something when you hear about your life?
Yeah, it maybe sounds a little more interesting than it was, but it was definitely, you know, mine took some time in my 20s to sort of get my act together, and I just happened to be doing that overseas as opposed to here. So.
But it really does make a difference in terms of how you view the world, doesn't it? I mean, to be playing professional baseball and also basketball, and to be, and also the work that you did. I forgot this part. You're doing, you worked as a bricklayer in Siberia, a migrant farm laborer, a moonshine dealer, a professional clown, a keeper in an elephant cage, a security guard, and a construction worker in an Orthodox monastery. How could I forget that part of the background? That helps your writing, I'm sure.
Well, one thing, you know, actually living in Russia, you know, and working, you know, I spent 7 years, I had my own paper in Moscow and covering the Russian government. Surprisingly turned out to be a very good education for covering the United States financial system. You know, the kind of corruption you see in a third world country where there's so much commingling between, you know, the big financial powers and the state. You know, I thought I was never going to see a story like that again after I left Russia. And now it turns out that I'm kind of looking at exactly the same thing here in the U.S. And I think it does give me some perspective that maybe, you know, other reporters don't have.
Yeah, and even being given a nice mention by Frank Rich in his column yesterday about your coverage.
Did he? I didn't notice.
Oh, you didn't see it?
No. What did he say?
It's in his. Hold on. I just happen to have the Week in Review with me. I gotta find it though. Yeah, you talked about your financial coverage. the most quoted sentence in financial journalism this year by Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone,
right,
describes the company as a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. There you are, Matt.
Yeah. Well, Goldman Sachs is they're one of the great literary villains of all time. I mean, I think they're one of those companies you can just completely imagine Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO, sitting there stroking a big fluffy cat in his office. And what's so interesting about the financial story is that most Americans don't really understand how a lot of this stuff works.
Right.
So because of that, these guys have been able to do an awful lot and get away with an awful lot for years without people really focusing on what it is they do. And now I think that's starting to change a little bit, and people are starting to pay a little bit more attention. And I think you're going to see these people demonized a little more, and I think that's a good thing.
Right. Before we get into healthcare, let's just talk about, what's this? I don't understand this stuff very well, to be honest. But we get this 10,000th mark again last week. Then we get these reports that Goldman Sachs and others are giving out incredible bonuses. We got the unemployment rate 15% in places like Michigan, and they're getting another, who knows how much money in bonuses after we bailed them out, and then they paid us back. What the heck is going on?
Well, first of all, they paid us back for the TARP, which is that's the part of the bailout that came from the Treasury. But that's only a small slice of it. That's maybe a 15th, a 20th of the actual bailout. Most of the bailout programs came from the Federal Reserve, and that money wasn't paid back. Now, the TARP came with restrictions. If you took that money, you weren't allowed to give big bonuses. So companies like Goldman Sachs paid that money back really quickly. But the other stuff, it basically allowed these other banks and Goldman Sachs to get money from the Federal Reserve basically for free. So what they're doing is they're getting cheap money and then they're lending it out to everybody else at market rates. And it doesn't take a genius to borrow money at 2% and lend it out at 6%. I mean, that's where all these bonuses are coming from. It's pure bailout. This is pure government subsidy, and people don't really understand that. They don't understand that this is a political decision that we made. We made a decision that when we bailed out this economy, we were going to bail out the people who made the mistakes and not the people who actually have home payments to make or credit card bills to make. We made that political decision, and it's still concealed from most people, and that's really kind of a shame.
So they're riding even higher now.
They are riding higher now, and as someone who I used to cover the campaign trail. I covered the 2004, 2008 as most of us political reporters. We were trained to cover the economy by looking at the indicators that Wall Street told us to look at. If the Dow is up, then we reported that the economy was doing well. And what's happening now is the Dow has gone back up over 10,000, so we're starting to see stories in the newspapers about how we're experiencing this big rebound.
Mm-hmm.
But go out and, ask people out there, in Wisconsin and Michigan and, rural Tennessee, North Texas, are they seeing a rebound? I bet they're not going to tell you that they're feeling a rebound. The rebound is happening in Wall Street. It's happening, in lower Manhattan, but it's not really happening anywhere else. But the problem is we don't have a press corps that's really equipped to cover that story effectively. And so, we're going to keep seeing that illusion played out in the press.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're digging into it. Healthcare. Why is it that single payer was never really on the table as we were talking about healthcare reform?
Well, most of the people that I talk to around Washington believe that there was a handshake deal made by the White House with the health insurance industry before this process even got started, that the White House was going to take single payer completely off the table in exchange for the health insurance industry not hammering the Obama administration the way that the Clinton administration was hammered when they tried to push through health care reform in the early 90s. That's why we did not see single-payer seriously considered by any of the committees that the Democrats were using to put together this bill. I mean, one of the most telling instances was when Max Baucus, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, when he opened up a roundtable to discuss possible options for how this health care bill was going to look, he invited 41 people to speak, and not a single one of them was a single-payer advocate. So there were no single-payer voices involved in this process at any point of this entire summer. The only way it got through was when a couple of rogue congressmen like Anthony Weiner kind of forced their way into the bill and got Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid to agree to put it in as an amendment to the bill. But it's not going to pass. I mean, that's just a symbolic thing. So, you know, that's single-payer was never part of the plan.
Right. Even though, I think I'm remembering your article correctly, the president's personal physician for some 22 years is a single-payer advocate, right?
Right, as are most physicians, actually. If you look at the polls, the public is not necessarily a majority in favor of single-payer plans. I think the number usually hovers around 40 to 43% for the general public. But physicians, have been majority in favor of single-payer for about 2 or 3 years now. The president's own physician, I forget what his name was, but he was Obama's doctor until a couple of years ago. He was actually invited to participate in a panel with President Obama on live television by ABC News earlier this summer, and the president didn't know about it. And apparently when the president found out that this doctor was going to be on and was going to be talking about single payer, suddenly he was disinvited from that show. Yeah. Now, I can't assert, affirmatively assert that it was because of that, but that's the sequence of events that happened.
Yeah. You know, when you say the public is in favor of this by 40 to 43%, the press would have us believe that it's maybe less than 1% and they're all socialists and communists and crazy.
Well, there are obviously lots of people who have lots of different polls out there. And it just kind of depends on which polls you want to pay attention to. I've seen polls going both directions on this issue, but I definitely know that the physicians, the key physicians lobby, they're definitely in favor of the polls that they've conducted show that doctors are heavily in favor of.
Right. Yeah, and everybody acted like that was such a surprise when that poll came out recently.
Right. Right. But it makes sense. I mean, my own fiance is a doctor, and doctors spend half their time filling out insurance forms. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to fill out a different form for every patient because every insurance company, there's nothing is standardized. It's a ridiculous waste of time. It's almost like a Kafka-esque kind of a system where it's almost comical. At this point, doctors are at the end of their rope. They just want something to be simple and easy, and the money is almost really secondary to just allowing them to do their jobs. And so it's amazing that they took it off the table completely because mm-hmm. I think it had a chance,
What did you say? There are something like 1,300 different insurance places that doctors have to respond to? 1,300?
Yeah, there were 1,300 different insurance providers in this country, and they all have different forms. So, when you have a patient and want to collect on, a bill from that patient's provider, you got to go through and do new paperwork for every single patient, and then it's not a piece of cake. It's not like you just fill out the form and send it out and you get your money back. They fight you for everything. You got to spend a lot of time on the phone. I mean, these are the doctors themselves have to do this because the hospitals, their staff has been cut down. So a lot of times it's the doctors themselves who are sitting there on the phone trying to haggle with these bureaucrats just to get, repaid for some kind of test result. I spoke to one hospital in Bayonne, New Jersey, and they told me that 50% of their administrative staff was devoted to chasing claims. I mean, that's all they do. They're not taking care of sick people. The people who work in hospitals now, what they do for a living is try to get money from insurance companies. Mm. I mean, it's just ridiculously inefficient.
To say nothing of the time that we spend on the phone with insurance companies asking, why didn't you cover this? You were supposed to.
Right, right. That's just the problem that doctors have. I mean, that's just, you know, not even including the problem that ordinary people have. I mean, of course, you know, politics doesn't even consider the problems that regular people have. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's an absurd system, and there's no reason why it has to be that way. But except for the fact that there's a small group of financially empowered people who are determined to not let it happen. And that's what we're seeing right now.
You have some very interesting things to say about a public option, that even if we were to get some kind of public option, people need to look at the fine print here, or it wouldn't be much of an option for us. Can you talk more about that? Is there a public option on the table in one of these bills that would give us choice for either our employer's plan or a public option? And would any of these plans bring down the cost of health care?
Well, there were five health care bills. There's two in the Senate and three in the House. And, you know, there were three different committees in the House that were working on health care bills. The first two had public options in them that were real. They were publicly run health care programs, and the pricing system was based on Medicaid rates plus 5%. So it was a cheap program. I mean, this was the kind of thing where if people were able to buy into this program, it would be very inexpensive. It would be government-run, so it would be standardized, and it would drive healthcare costs down across the board because private companies would be forced to compete with this kind of a plan. What happened then was that in the third committee, I believe it was the Energy and Commerce Committee, it's Waxman's committee, the Blue Dogs revolted, these conservative Democrats, and they held out, and their excuse was that they wanted more compensation for rural doctors in the bill. So they held out for a change to the public option that would have eliminated that Medicaid plus 5% rate and made it a much more expensive plan going forward. So now, because of that, if there is a public option in the bill, which there probably won't be, I mean, that they're almost because of what's going on in the Senate, there almost certainly won't be a public option. But if there is one, it's going to be not significantly cheaper than private health insurance, and so it's not going to perform the primary function that a public option would have performed, which is to drive costs down. So it's basically meaningless.
Well, it's kind of crazy, isn't it? Because driving costs down was one of the big reasons we needed health care. Everybody's hurting because of the cost.
Right, and they went through and they tinkered with the bill in little places here and there to make sure that there weren't any real savings anywhere. I mean, one of the most shameful things that happened with this bill was that pharma, which is the lobbying group that represents the pharmaceutical industry, and is headed by a former Louisiana congressman named Billy Tozen, who incidentally took his job about 2 weeks after he finished pushing through the prescription drug benefit bill. So he had a private meeting with Rahm Emanuel and some other folks in the White House in the middle of the summer, and they agreed to put up $150 million to publicize the Obama health care plan, basically to push for it. And in exchange for that, the Obama White House is now pushing for a health care bill that will not allow the government to negotiate bulk rates for pharmaceuticals for Medicaid or Medicare. So basically the pharmaceutical industry didn't want the government to be able to buy cheap drugs. And in order to get that, they gave the White House $150 million of publicity. And that's the way it works in Washington. It's a handshake deal that was done between a couple of politicians in a back room. And all this other stuff that happened out in public was just a dog and pony show for the rest of us. That was the real deal right there.
If, though, a president, Matt, has made this a signature issue, he campaigned on this, he talks about how important it is, how can he be behind a bill that would do virtually nothing and, in fact, may even increase costs for health care?
That's the million-dollar question, right? Why would Barack Obama do this? I mean, I followed Barack Obama around for 18 months. I'm sure everybody else who voted for him watched him very closely, and he appears very genuinely to be, you know, an intellectual, a person who comes from humble enough beginnings to that he should have, you know, sympathy with ordinary people. But he has definitely come up politically through the school of this sort of modern Democratic Party, which is very, very pragmatic and believes in working closely with the business community. And I think what they think, I think what they sincerely believe is that if they get something they can call health care passed, that this is going to benefit them politically in two ways. Number one, it's something that they can campaign on. And number two, they're going to keep all the money, the campaign contributions that would have gone to the Republican Party for the next couple of election cycles. That money is now going to go to the Democratic Party for, 2010 and 2012. So they figure it's the best of both worlds. They're gonna be able to say they passed health care and they're gonna get all the money. It's a very cynical way of looking at it, and it's completely out of touch with reality. But if you spend enough time in Washington, this is the kind of stuff that starts to make sense to politicians. And it's a terrible tragedy if this is where Barack Obama's head is right now.
Matt Taibbi is our guest this hour, and we're going to welcome phone calls. The article that we're referencing, Sick and Wrong, was posted September 3rd at rollingstone.com. You can find the article, and we're going to go to you in a moment. Our number, 800-486-8655. The lines are filled right now, but you'll be able to get through as soon as we say hello and hear from somebody and then say goodbye. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Matt Taibbi is our guest. We start our calls with Brad. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Matt.
Hi, Brad.
One thing I wanted to mention is some congressmen like Amy Klobuchar in Minnesota, they want to cut health care costs by emulating HMOs, by having us see a primary care provider, gatekeeper doctor that would allow or deny us referral to a specialist. I think this would be a mistake because a Medicare for All plan, like you mentioned, would allow us to see any doctor that we choose and pretty much in the nation. And I think this is a point that really hasn't been mentioned that much in the press, the ability of choice with a Medicare for All plan and what a great advantage that would be to patients. And I wonder if you could comment a little bit on that.
What does the Klobuchar plan do exactly again? I'm sorry.
Well, I saw her on the news this weekend, and she was saying that a good way to cut costs is by emulating a state like Minnesota, where patients there, most of them are in HMOs, and so they go to a general practitioner who then will then refer them out to specialists. So you have to see the primary care provider first before you can get a referral.
Okay.
So, it's kind of like Big Brother looking out for you and where you can go and limiting your access to providers and probably still keeping you in a network where you're very limited with your choice.
This is a sort of more along the lines of the co-op plan that they're thinking of doing in the Senate Finance Committee. Is that the idea?
I think so. I mean, she highlighted Mayo Clinic, for example, where you go there and you see your first stop is a primary care provider, and then they decide and make all the decisions on who you get to see in terms of specialists. And it really takes choice away from the patient. You're really kind of at the mercy of the general practitioner as to which specialists you can see and what they think needs to be done for your care.
Well, unfortunately, I'm not familiar with exactly what she's talking about specifically, but I do know that the word has kind of gotten around in Congress that any proposal that anybody comes up with that has any kind of a public aspect to it, the government being the arbiter of any of care of any kind, is going to be a non-starter. So what you're going to see instead are a lot of proposals that revolve around new, types of private co-ops or, some kind of HMO-type plan. Some of them are good. I think Senator Ron Wyden's Free Choice Act is an interesting plan that, unfortunately, has been killed already. But this is the kind of thing that we're going to see going forward is some kind of, again, a private solution that somehow avoids either a public option or single payer. And I don't know. I'm kind of with you. I just don't see how it's going to work.
Thanks very much for the call, Brad. We go to Brian next from Richland. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment that I think that you know, I think it's a great idea to go through healthcare reform, but I think it's being lost a little bit in the nationalizing of healthcare. I think that healthcare reform is very important and can be accomplished in different ways, like Matt was talking about how doctors spend so much time and the entire healthcare system is so wrapped up in filling out forms and dealing with the insurance industry, that I think a standardization there would save a lot of time and a lot of money. And I think that also one of the things that needs to be addressed before getting into any of the rest of it is things like where we're paying $3 of Tylenol when we go to the hospital. And I think that once they can regulate some of these costs, then we can start looking at other things, maybe a maybe an add-on to unemployment insurance, or maybe an expansion of Medicaid benefits. But I think once they start to once they get past the big the cost problem and start looking at the actual nationalization, that they should look at something like the VA system and see what's right and what's wrong and build on that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, they need to solve the cost problem clearly. You know, there are a lot of built-in extra costs that don't need to be there. There are enormous government subsidies in the form of, you know, patent protections that have existed for years. And in fact, actually, this healthcare bill that they're about to pass is going to significantly expand some of those patent protections. In particular, you know, there's a not sure if you're familiar with what biologics are, but it's not pharmaceuticals in the form of pills, but it's usually something like, you know, artificial plasma, anything you hang from a bag, you know, that is administered intravenously. The patent protection used to be 5 years for that. They've expanded it to 13 under this new bill. So that's going to be that. It's going to make it that farther away for us to get access to generic drugs, which again is going to keep costs high. They've just managed to make it difficult in this bill to do the right thing, to get rid of all the excess paperwork, to give us access to generic drugs, and to standardize the process. And those are the things that we needed to do to reduce costs, and none of those things are happening.
Hmm. You also write about Medicaid in your article and the states taking on an increased number of people on Medicaid, depending on how they look at the poverty level and whether or not there would be a national level under somebody's plan, which could ultimately bankrupt some states.
Right, right. Yeah, as it stands, there's a state-by-state system. Each state has its own determination of who qualifies for Medicaid and who doesn't. For instance, in a state like Vermont, you can make up to three times the poverty level and still qualify for Medicaid. Whereas in a state like Georgia, you actually have to be at or near the poverty level to qualify for Medicaid. What they're going to do is they're going to make everybody who's up to about 300% of the poverty level either fully qualified for Medicaid, or you're going to get some kind of a government subsidy. What's not clear is where that money comes from. You know, originally when the government said, hey, we're going to start expanding the Medicaid pool to include, you know, all these people, you know, 300% of the poverty level, they originally said, hey, don't worry, this is all going to be federal money. It's all going to come out of our pocket. But then kind of at the last minute in a couple of the bills, some of the senators started saying, well, what we're really going to do is we're going to make it all federal money for the first 5 years, and then after that, the states are going to have to take care of that excess money. And, you know, the states are already going bankrupt because of Medicaid. If we start, you know, expanding the Medicaid pool by two and three times, and let's not forget that people are now going to have insurance. It's going to be against, you know, you're going to have a tax penalty if you don't sign up. So expand the pool enormously. There's going to be a catastrophic effect on the states if this thing goes the way it's now designed.
Yeah. Thanks, Brian, for the call. Steve is next from Viroqua. Hi, Steve.
Yes, Mr. Taibbi, you're doing the most important print investigation around, and thank you, Rolling Stone.
Thank you.
I don't know how your head doesn't burst with all this toxic insanity, but I want you to connect all the dots. By the way, it was Dr. Quentin Young, Hyde Park, Chicago, that Obama dissed.
Right.
Mike Malloy on Air America says that when the Dems fall down on this whole cave into the insurance business, that's going to destroy the Dems, and basically it's going to mark the emergence of what Mussolini called fascism, that is corporatism, openly controlling Wall Street, the Pentagon, oil and coal, climate disruption, the whole big mess. But now you use the word revolt. I want to know, do you mean by revolt, do you mean just drop out of the whole money system? Or do you mean be like the brave students or Taliban and actively try to blow apart the system with improvised explosive devices? Keep up the good work, Mr. Sutai.
Well, I certainly don't favor that, but I think that there could be a legislative revolt in this bill that would be like historic and significant if it happens. If they send a bill to the floor that doesn't have a public option, that doesn't have any savings on pharmaceuticals, that's as bad as we've been talking about. I know that there are 60 or 70 votes in the House from progressive party, the Democrats, that are teetering, that are thinking about not supporting the bill. And there's a good 10 to 15 votes in the Senate that are also thinking about not voting for this thing. If this bill ends up getting killed by progressive Democrats, by their own party, that will save the Democratic Party. That will be a moment where we can look back and say, hey, you know, this party actually did something for its constituents. It did what it's supposed to do. And that's good. If it fails at doing that, if this thing goes through and those people don't end up opposing the bill, then we have a situation like what you're talking about, where it's really just kind of a one-party state, and there are cosmetic differences between the two parties, and really the ordinary person doesn't really have any serious alternatives, and that's really, really scary, and I think that's why we have to pay so much attention to this healthcare bill, because it's a historic moment. It's kind of a make or break moment for the Democrats. Are they gonna go this one way, or are they gonna go the other way? And I think we have to pay a lot of attention to that.
And what they were supposed to do, unless I'm reading polls wrong here, is give their constituents real reform in healthcare. Isn't that what we were asking for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember when I was covering the campaign, I was on the trail for 18 months. Everywhere I went, people were telling me basically the same stories. I mean, they were saying, I can't afford to buy groceries anymore for two reasons. Number one, gas prices are too high. And number two, my health insurance costs are ridiculous. Or I don't have insurance and I'm sick and I have to pay out of my own pocket, for my health insurance costs. And it's not a livable situation for enormous numbers of people in this country. And if we, that we elect this president, there was so much enthusiasm when he gets elected. They have a majority in both houses, and they still don't deliver it. They still don't fix that problem. Where is that going to leave everybody? I mean, I mean, I don't know. I can't even imagine where everybody goes from there if this thing doesn't get fixed.
Mm-hmm. And talk about what process happens here now. So much was made of the Senate Finance Committee. Is that for some reason the bill that's really at the top of the list here, or would other bills have as much a deciding what the final bill is going to be?
Well, this is another one of those peculiarities of the how bills get made in Congress. The reality is that what's going to end up happening is that they're going to combine the two Senate bills first, then they're going to combine the three House bills into some kind of form. They're probably going to be very similar. They're going to get voted on. If they both pass, then it goes to conference committee, where there's sort of a joint group of people from the Senate and the House who hammer out the final language of the bill. One thing that most people aren't really aware of is that that conference committee can basically rewrite the bill completely if they feel like it. They can completely change the meeting, make it opposite to what they voted on and discuss publicly. But the reality is, you know, the word in Washington is that the Baucus bill, the Senate Finance Committee bill, that's where the real action is. Whatever comes out of that committee is what is going to be decided upon afterwards in Congress. In other words, if the Baucus bill comes out and there's no public option in that bill, despite the fact that there's a public option in all three of the House bills, the final bill that comes out of conference is not going to have a public option in it. And that's, you know, it has nothing to do with voting. It has nothing to do with anything. It just has to do with what the Democratic Party has decided to do internally. So yeah, that's the bill that matters.
And where is the president in this? You quote Robert Reich, the former Labor Secretary under Clinton, saying that the president has got to go in there and give it coherence. All of the people were making the talk show rounds yesterday, Emanuel and Axelrod and others, saying Valerie Jarrett, well, a public option is important to the president, but it's not the be all and end all. What were they saying?
Well, the president is taking the position that he's not supposed to bully the Congress into making the bill the way he wants it to be, and I guess technically that's kind of true. Typically, you know, the White House is not supposed to dictate to the Congress what the shape of a final bill, but this isn't an unusual situation, and this is a situation where there are a lot of members of Congress who really needed to see some leadership from the president. And they also, you know, they would have had a lot more political capital to work with if the president had stood up and said, hey, I'm not going to sign any bill that doesn't have a public option in it. Well, how much easier do you think that would make it for somebody like, you know, Jay Rockefeller in the Senate or, you know, Olympia Snowe in, you know, who's a Republican in Maine? How much easier do you think that would make it for them to actually sign off on a bill with a public option? And it would make it a lot easier.
Right.
But Obama hasn't done that. He hasn't shown any leadership at all in this. He's basically said, I'm going to take my hands off and let everybody else deal with it. And, you know, to me, that's like the opposite of leadership. He should have done something serious here.
Instead, Olympia Snow will make the decision.
Right, exactly. Or, you know, the typically in the way that works is they'll promise her, you know, a gazillion dollars in highway money for the next 5 years. She'll take that, and maybe she'll end up voting for whatever, you know, crappy bill ends up coming out of her committee. But it would be a lot easier. They could have done this a different way. They could have basically, you know, held her, you know, her feet to the fire and said, if you don't vote for this thing, you're going to be in trouble. And they didn't do it that way. And instead, they're kind of leaving it to chance.
Matt Taibbi is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now from Matt, and Brian from Green Bay is next. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I was just responding to the first caller about the concept of having a family practitioner be a gatekeeper. I think all the successful systems in Europe and in Asia use that same concept. It's a great way to keep people from asking for test after test after test after test. So I guess I was kind of curious why that seems to be a problem with this current bill. And the other thing that, since you started talking, I'm totally confused why Olympia Snowe's vote was significant at all. The fact that she was the only Republican that voted for it didn't make a single bit of difference. It would have passed with or without her vote.
Yeah, I was sort of confused by that, too.
Well, there were two problems to answer the Olympia Snowe question. During the summer, when they wanted to get 60 votes for this thing, and they had a problem. They had two problems. One was that Ted Kennedy was probably not going to be able to vote, and the other was that Robert Byrd was also, they thought he was going to be too sick to vote. So they all thought they were going to need two Republicans in order to hit that 60 number. And so they were working very, very hard on Olympia Snowe, and, you know, Mike Enzi was another guy that they were really hoping to get. And that's why one of the concessions that they made to the Republicans was that they were going to have this group of six negotiating deal in the Senate Finance Committee. You know, instead of having the natural Democratic majority in the Senate Finance Committee, they split it right down the middle with three Republicans and three Democrats, and they were the architects of the Baucus bill. And that was the concession that they made to the Republicans in the hopes of trying to get those two extra Republican votes. So that's the explanation for that. That they were really banking on a couple of conservative, more centrist leaning Republicans in order to hit that 60 number.
Thanks very much, Brian, for the call. Let's go to Jan next. Hi, Jan. Jan, are you there? Jan is doing something else. Chase from Milwaukee. Hi, Chase.
Hi.
Hi.
I have just listening to how you need the Republican votes. It sounds like you're talking about filibuster proof. But my question is, we voted Obama into the White House. We have the Senate. We have the House. A Democrat's lead. It's curious of, like, if all the Democrats were voted in by people who voted Democrat, why do they seem to, that they want to listen to the Republicans? Why can't they just move forward with their plans and their bill to pass this?
I totally agree with you. I don't see any reason why they had to pay attention to the Republicans at all. I mean, I'm just telling you what I heard over the summer. What I kept hearing from people is that we want to get that 60 number.
Right.
But I very clearly remember the Bush years when, you know, the Bush strategy for passing anything was to, you know, get the minimum plus one, you know, and if they had anybody who was holding back, like for instance on CAFTA, you know, they would, if any of their own members decided they were going to revolt on any bill, they would basically take him in a back room and tell him, you know, you're not going to get any money for, you know, highway appropriations for the next 10 million years. Or, and like, there was one famous instance where a guy was not going to vote for CAFTA, and they told him that if he didn't change his vote, they were going to run somebody else against his son in another district. And, you know, that's the way the Republicans played it. They played hardball. They never, ever felt like they needed to include the Democrats in any discussions, and they didn't have the majority that the Democrats have right now. The Democrats could have done this. They could have just taken this bill and done whatever they wanted to. They could have taken a maximum position with single payer and maybe negotiated their way down to a single payer plan or something, to a public option or something like that. Instead, they made this huge show of wanting to do this in a bipartisan fashion, but the Republicans were never going to give them anything. They were never going to support this bill. You know, the best they were maybe going to get is somebody like Olympia Snow flipping sides for something, you know, in exchange for whatever it is they gave her.
And, I mean, if you're voted in and you're a Democrat and you want to please a Republican, I don't think a Republican's going to vote for you next time. He's going to revoke.
You're exactly right. This whole notion of, oh, let's bend over backwards to make a concession to the Republican base or whatever it is, or let's take out the non-existent death panel, language, which is a complete absurdity to begin with. I don't know what this is all about. I don't know why they were doing that, except maybe just as cover, as an excuse for why they watered down the bill. You know, for the real reason they watered down the bill, which was that their campaign contributors wanted it watered down. If they wanted an excuse, now they can say, oh, we were bowing to pressure from the Republicans, and maybe that's what it's all about. But certainly they didn't need to do that.
Well, what about these blue doggers, though, that we keep hearing about who are not going to support a public option?
Well, the blue dogs, you know, they tend mostly to come from socially very conservative districts in rural areas in the Midwest and in the South, and their votes were definitely in play, but in the end they were going to support a healthcare bill in the end if the leadership told them to. They just wanted to extract their price for it, and their price just happened to be a big chunk of pork, which was really interesting because the Blue Dog's ostensible ideology is reducing government spending and reducing waste and earmarks and all of that, but what they got in exchange for their revolt on the public option issue was a gigantic piece of government pork that they're going to throw at rural doctors. You know, the increase in the rate for the public option that they wanted, all it is a huge government subsidy and you know, an increase in the federal outlay. And so it's completely contrary to what they're supposedly standing for, but, you know, that's what they asked for and that's what they got.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Hannah from Muskego. Hi.
Hi. I just heard you talking about the doctors, how much I have to deal with the insurance and all that. And it just something came on my mind with what I was dealing this late summer when I went with my daughter to pick up some raspberries, and she got into her foot just a little tiny torn. And because it swollen, had some infection to it in the evening, then I decided, well, I would take it out by myself, but she's 4-year-old. She does not going to let me to do it. I will take her to the pediatrician the next day morning. So we went there, and the doctor looks on it, and I see the torn there, and I thinking like, okay, he's going to take it out. But no, he sent me to the major hospital, then to the surgeon there. Surgeon comes, and she's talking about doing ultrasound, doing CT scan on her, prescribing antibiotics, and doing the next day outpatient surgery.
Oh, my gosh.
And for a
I'm
corn,
like,
right?
Oh, my God. I was thinking, like, this is going to take only, like, 30 minutes, and we are out for the day.
Right, and that's going to end up costing,
all day in a hospital, then we are going actually to have the ultrasound, and I'm asking, so do you see there something? And she's saying, no, I don't. Well, I see it swollen, and so, you know, I see that too, even without the ultrasound, you know, and I'm like, this is spending money, like, why? I remember I'm from Czech Republic, but if something like that happened at home or, like, from what I heard from my relatives, I mean, you take it to the doctor, they hold your foot down, and they take it out, and there's some antiseptic on it, and you are done, you know? And and does they are serious, or what they mean? Plus, my daughter, she has a serious heart condition. She has a Marfan syndrome, and putting her down for full anesthesia, I mean, that can be truly health-threatening for her, you know? And so, anyway, so we spent all day in a hospital. My son, I have a one-year-old son. I had to have him there with me. He was just exhausted, crying, and then in the evening, finally, we got home. And I told this to my husband, and I said, well, I'm going to do something. I'm not going to let her go to the surgery, full surgery the next day because of tiny torn in her foot.
Right. Matt.
This is the problem with our system. It's screwed up on so many different levels. I mean, one of the things that you have that's a major problem is that doctors are terrified of litigation, so they overtest for everything because they want to be absolutely sure that they have every base covered. So, you know, you come in there with a scratch in your toe, and they're going to end up testing you for the West Nile virus and, you know, every disease that they can possibly think of. But then the other problem is the hospitals make most of their money from procedures and, you know, things like surgical procedures. So if there's any reason at all to put somebody under anesthesia or, you know, give them some kind of an operation, they're going to try to do that. But then the other problem, of course, is that the insurance companies are going to try to end up denying that coverage. And so this whole dynamic is in play where, you know, the hospitals are going to try to do one thing, the doctors are going to try to do another thing, and none of it is really, nobody's primary motivation is to just to do the sensible thing and take care of the medical issue. They all have to worry about all these other economic issues that have nothing to do with getting people better, and that's what we're not fixing with this bill.
Mm-hmm. Is something good going to emerge, though, even though it may not be significant? Will something good emerge from all of this?
Yeah, there are going to be a lot of things that are going to be good. There's going to be, you know, a provision that people can't be denied for pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be an enormous amount of subsidies for people who can't afford health insurance and, you know, who are near the poverty level. But there's also, you know, I would argue that this bill has more negatives than positives in the end, because the two things, the one thing in it that's really going to have teeth is the individual mandate. That's the thing that's going to force people to get health insurance, or else they're going to pay a tax penalty. So now you have to get insurance, and if you're in that kind of sweet spot between where you can get a subsidy and, you know, where you're getting really good health insurance from your employer, or then you're going to be forced to become a customer of a private company. And that's probably going to, you know, affect 15, 16, 17 million people in this
wow.
country. They're going to have to become customers. And, I don't know. It just seems to me like that there's a lot of negatives in this bill and very few positives.
Yeah. So when are you getting married?
next June.
All right. June. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us. I love your writing, and I love your dad's work, too. I think it's great.
I'll let him know.
Okay. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we enjoyed the hour. Matt Taibbi, his piece that we were referencing, Sick and Wrong, September 3rd, Rolling Stone. And you can find it by going to rollingstone.com. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, and to Rob as well for on-air production. And thanks for your calls, everybody.